If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey, welcome back, everyone, to the story tonight. It is part four, right? So we're getting close to the end, as there's still one more to go. But let me tell you, part four is extremely terrifying. They make some crazy decisions and take some wild risks. And let me tell you, Jason, Naomi, and Max are really in for it this time. Stay tuned. If you're new to the channel, subscribe, click on that bell, and smash that thumbs up and tell a friend. As the sun rose, we walked down the 15 stories of thin metal stairs. The radio tower had given us a good view of the Deathcap Mountains, and I had seen what looked to be a small town between us and the nearest peak. Despite Max having been trapped here for months, he had never been this far down the road.
"There was one couple that went as far as the town and returned to the visitor center," he told Naomi and me. "They said there was horrible things there, things that looked like regular American people but weren't. They had a dog with them, and when they returned, the dog was gone. Apparently the people in the town had stabbed it to death and eaten it raw right in front of them, and it was only that distraction that allowed them to get away at all. They owed their life to that dog."
"So where did they end up going?" I asked, curious.
"Well, they waited for night and tried returning. Said they planned on driving through the town as fast as they could when those things were asleep. If indeed they slept at all. I never saw or heard from them again." Max shrugged, his worn button-up shirt loose on his body. He had apparently lost a lot of weight since first being trapped here. "Maybe they made it out. People seem to think there's an exit down the road, somewhere in the Deathcap Mountains. But I don't know where they heard that or how they figured it out, seeing as no one has ever came back as far as I know."
"Maybe it has something to do with the white light feeling we're all getting earlier," Naomi said. "I swear I could see thoughts and memories, Jason. Some of yours too, Max. And there was a feeling of immense peace and weightlessness. As if I knew everything would be all right. Even despite all the abominations and our probable impending deaths at the land of some cultists." As if speaking it had brought it into life, I got hit with another blast of that same energy. My vision went white, and I heard a voice like rushing water booming through my head. It didn't speak in English or in any other human language, but I understood it completely in my heart nonetheless. To this day, I don't know if it was an angel or God or just some hallucination, but it was one of the most profound and bizarre experiences of my life.
"You will find solace at the clearing at the end," it said, shaking my entire body.
I saw huge white auras around Max and Naomi that vibrated, and their eyes widened in shock. I realized they could feel it too. Luckily, we had reached the bottom of the tower, or all three of us may have tumbled down the stairs in surprise.
"There is an evil here, the one who brings the dead lights and infects those he stole. But your purity is stronger. Don't be afraid, even though not all of you will survive this. This is what the path has been leading to, the path of your entire lives. And not just these roads of dust and dirt."
As the voice faded, the white light started to fade too, and my vision returned to normal. I felt a deep throbbing throughout my body, like a high-tension wire that got jolted with way too much electricity. But it felt good, somehow powerful and right, as if I had been waiting for that contact my whole life and never realized how much I was missing. There was another aspect to it, though. A feeling that an impending evil was waiting for me, knew exactly where I was, and was expecting me. I could almost see the face of that evil, in a psychic sense, like it was standing right behind me and staring into my mind. And yet, I had no choice but to continue to approach it. It was too late to turn back, so all we could do was brace ourselves for what was to come. As we approached the car, I knew something was wrong. I looked cockeyed and saw that the tires had been all slashed, the front windshield and driver's side window had been smashed, and the steering wheel was literally been ripped out of its column. It hung out on the driver's window, attached by a mess of wires, like a severed limb hanging on by a single tendon. All three of us stopped in our tracks, mouths open and eyes wide as we surveyed the damage. As usual, Max recovered first and spoke in his direct way.
"Well, I guess we're walking," he said,
a bit of amusement in his voice.
"It was inevitable anyways. It would take longer, and we certainly wouldn't be able to carry as much if we could in the car. But it might also be quieter and allow us more time to see upcoming dangers."
I sighed in exasperation. "The ammo and all the water seem to be the heaviest parts," I said. "We need to decide how much we could split up between the three of us, and whether there are fresh streams of water we can trust. If there are, we could carry much less water and just refill the bottles on the way. If the beginning of the mountain is only 20 miles or so, which is what it looked like from the top of the tower, I think we could do that in a day, assuming we could walk about 3 miles an hour with all the equipment and guns." "And that means," Naomi said, her face gaining a sour and unhappy expression, "we need to camp out. It's already 11 a.m. now, and by the time we get this crap together, it'll probably be noon. We have no tent, no sleeping bags, nothing."
"Ah, you kids," Max said, laughing. "You don't need a dang tent and sleeping bag just to sleep outside. Our ancestors survived hundreds of thousands of years without tents and sleeping bags. Plus, it looks like there's going to be some sort of town up ahead, about halfway to the mountains. We could just stop there for the night."
So that was our plan. We ended up filling canvas bags and backpacks in the trunk with as much provisions as we could carry and headed out. The sun showed brightly without a cloud in the sky, and the wind blew lightly. I had a light jacket on but had to remove it due to all the ammo, food, and water weighing down on me, not to mention the gun I carried. After a few hours of walking along the road, the forest started to open up and cliffs surrounded us on both sides. There were streams running across the road now too, but someone had built wooden bridges by splitting trees in half and nailing them together. They reminded me of Lincoln logs with something incredibly sturdy. We began by walking up a massive hill and after reaching the top, saw a breathtaking sight. Purple-hued mountains rose tens of thousands of feet in the air behind a small town that followed along a dirt street. Huge Victorian houses of all colors rose on both sides, and a massive castle stood at the end. Smoke billowed from chimneys up and down the street. It reminded me of vacation towns I had seen in the Berkshires, though these mountains looked even higher than those in New Hampshire or Vermont. Near their peaks, clouds blended and obscured the snowy tips. Even though where we stood, there wasn't a single cloud in the sky, and the weather was far too warm for any snow. We had only a few hours left of sunlight, so we began to walk faster to reach the town before dark. Regardless of whether we liked it or not, we had to stop and sleep eventually. Within an hour, we had in sight the first massive Victorian houses. Now that I was closer, I could see small shops interspersed between the houses. They looked quaint and huge glass windows and clean, freshly swept sidewalks lining all of it. Compared to the horrors we had seen earlier, this town looked entirely out of place. Yet still I saw no people. As we walked into the town, I saw movement in the windows of the shops and the houses. It looked like each building had multiple people moving throughout, but to me they only appeared as fleeting silhouettes. I checked to make sure the safety on my gun was off and that a round was loaded in the chamber.
"You guys got your game face on?"
Max asked us. We both nodded. Just then, an old hunched-over man with a black suit and a fedora stepped out of the nearest shop, which was labeled Harvey's Meats.
"Good afternoon, travelers,"
he said with what sounded like a deep Maine accent.
"You must have come far to see our beautiful little haven. Can I interest you in some fresh food?"
He languidly opened his hand and gestured to the shop behind him. Through the windows, I could see human corpses slit down the middle, hung on racks like deer. A few decapitated heads were visible on the serving trays behind the counter. At a few small round tables, people ate voraciously, smearing blood on their faces as they stripped the rare meat away from the bone. I saw them chewing on thighs, arms, and even cheeks of dead men, women, and children. Their eyes were wide.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
And staring, and they ate as if they had been starving for years, throwing the bones in the corner as they had finished and grabbed another heap of human meat from the table as soon as they were done.
"Get back, old man,"
Max said, raising his AR-15. I also raised my shotgun and aimed it at the center mass, ready for any tricks. Naomi kept watching behind us. I saw Naomi turn to make sure no one came from our backs as Max and I kept a close eye on this strange man and his shop of cannibals.
"My name is Harvey,"
he said, pretending not even to hear Max's threat. He inched closer to us, using a cane to support most of his weight. He couldn't have been more than 4.5 feet tall, a diminutive and slow figure. But still, my instincts told me we were all in danger.
"I am the mayor of our little town, which we call Deathcap's Haven. No one passes through here without my permission, I'm afraid."
He looked genuinely sorry at this. His smile turned into a slight frown.
"Old man, where have all the people come from?"
Max said, taking the leadership role as he did naturally as a former federal agent.
"How did you build this town here? And where is the way back?" Questions, questions, questions,"
Harvey said, giving us a wicked grin but answering none of them. In the silence, I could hear the smacking of lips and the rending of flesh as the cannibals in the shop continued to eat faster and faster.
"I have a question of my own, if you don't mind. Are you ready to die?"
In those words, all the silhouettes I had seen in the houses and shops began moving faster. The people started pouring out of the doors. The cannibals, with blood still dripping down their chins and staining their shirts, burst forward from the shops. The townspeople stood arranged behind Harvey in a triangular shape, with him as the head, with every one of the hundreds of eyes on us.
"We have company behind us too,"
Naomi said. And I turned and saw black clawed cultists coming out from the woods. There were dozens of monks, dressed to look similar to Buddhist monks, but the jet black robes instead of orange. She raised her gun at them, but didn't fire. All the newcomers formed a semicircle around us, staring with the hatred and anger at our presence.
"Well, it looks like the party's all here,"
Harvey said, laughing a dry, dusty laugh that chilled me to the bone. The only possible exit that I saw was the door at the meat shop, which was only blocked by a couple of people. But going backwards or forwards was for now impossible. Max looked at me, motioned to the door, and nodded. Grabbing Naomi's arm, I pulled her and we began to run as fast as we could towards the door to Harvey's Meats. Max raised the gun, firing at the blood-stained cannibal who lunged at us. I raised my Mossberg and shot another cannibal who was sprinting towards Naomi with a rabid look on his blood-covered face. The smell that hit us when we entered the shop was overwhelming, indescribably horrible. I have never smelled anything like this, and I never hope to. It smelled like a combination of meat that had been left out to rot for weeks. Feces, thyme, rosemary, mint, and cooking beef. I gagged a little in my throat as Max and I dragged a table in front of the door, turning it to the side and wedged it underneath the door handle.
"Oh, God, the smell,"
Naomi said, gagging slightly. The townspeople began to smash at the large plate glass windows that lined the front of the shop. We saw that the shop continued behind the counter, and all three of us ran at once, with Max making the rear, keeping his gun pointed backwards. I heard a smashing sound, and then the tread of dozens of heavy feet. In the back of the shop was a kitchen area lined with cages on one side. In them, naked, shivering children looked at me, still alive but looking half-starved. Their cages were lined with feces and urine, and they yelled at us for help as we ran past. A back door opened out onto the forest, and Naomi smashed through it as fast as she could. I ran behind her, grateful to be out of the stench of the area, but the townspeople caught up with Max and began to grab him. I started shooting, sending three of them to the ground, and I stopped to join his fire. The buckshot totally obliterated the face of the fourth, and I grabbed Max's arm and pulled him away from the hungry, grasping arms of the townfolk. We began to run blindly into the woods, through thorns and brambles, getting slapped in the face by branches and twigs and yet never slowing. The sun began to set, and before I knew it, we were lost in the woods, far from any trail and with no idea where the road lay.
"Stop, guys,"
I said, panting, my lungs burning. I doubled over, trying to catch my breath.
"We lost him, but I think we're also lost ourselves."
"Oh, God," Naomi said. "Did you see those kids in the cages? I think they're planning on eating them."
"I guess it's their form of veal," Max said dryly.
Naomi looked at him, horrified.
"Is that your idea of a joke? We need to get those kids out of there," she responded.
"Look, Naomi,"
I said. "We don't even know how to get ourselves out of here. I don't even know where the hell we are. We need to find our way back to the road. So much for stopping the rest of the town."
My stomach rumbled. We all decided to sit down and eat some chips and protein bars, chug a couple bottles of water, and try to come up with a plan. As we ate in silence, we began to hear singing and humming coming from a couple of miles off. It sounded like the townspeople had gathered on the road and began to celebrate. We followed the noises back towards the town, using our flashlights to navigate the thick brush. By the time we ended up near the road, we were behind a large Victorian house, much farther into the town than we had originally started. It had a large porch in the back. I tried the door, but it was locked, so Max came up and kicked it in with one booted foot. The house had paintings all over the walls, paintings of the monsters we had seen, paintings of the children in the cages, paintings of cannibals ripping the flesh off of the people's bones, paintings of the people being burned alive or sacrificed in rituals. They covered nearly every square inch of the walls.
"Do you like my work?"
a voice said from behind us. I turned and saw a young-looking Asian man in a black monk's robe.
"I created this place thousands of years ago, and I have lived here ever since. Yes, it changes with the times, but I haven't. Not really. Deep down, I have always been the same."
As he finished talking, his voice deepened and stretched out, sounding demonic and lower than a human voice could ever go.
"Who are you?"
I asked.
"My name is Mara,"
he said, returning to his pleasant, impassively low voice.
"And I created this road and kept it connected to your world to feed my children. Back in ancient India, I made a pact with all the demons of the hell world that they could use me, work through me, and in exchange, I could get immense powers and be nearly immortal. They told me I had to commit the unspeakable acts first. To kill my mother and my father. To kill a saint. To delude thousands of people and draw them with me. I did all of it, and made many more sacrifices than that, and strengthened myself through meditation and gained the 7 psychic powers of the Great Being. Now I maintain this road with my mind, and all the minds of the demons who still thrive here. They are fed well, for I connect this road to many parts of the world and allow newcomers in.
Max pointed his AR-15 at Mara and tried to bully him into cooperation.
"How about you let us the hell out of here and I don't shoot you in the head, Mara," he said.
Mara smiled, and Max screamed, dropping the gun. I could see smoke rising from his fingers.
"It burns me!"
Max screamed, looking down at his gun in horror.
"I suggest you two also put down your weapons," Mara said. "I am not trying to hurt you, at least not yet."
With a look at Max's black, scalded fingertips, I did so, and Naomi followed my lead. I doubted a gun would hurt this being anyways, if he was as powerful as he said.
"Now, how about we all sit and have a little chat?"
he said, pointing to the kitchen, where a long table surrounded by chairs waited for us. We all moved cautiously to the table and sat down.
"So, I am a responsible man," Mara said,
pulling up.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Out the chair, the head of the table, and sitting down himself.
"I will, of course, let you all out. All I want in exchange is your souls."
I laughed.
"Our souls?"
I said, feeling hysterical. "Is that even a real thing? And if it is, how could someone live without it?"
"Oh yes, it is very real,"
Mara said, smiling wide and showing far too many teeth. It looked like his teeth had been filed to sharp points.
"That white light that you likely felt, that is the soul of the road interacting with your souls, strengthening it, and intermingling with it. The power here is so much greater than on your side of the veil. But you can certainly live without your souls. We'll even be alive and healthy even without them. You could leave here and live full lives. Then, when you die, you will be eternally bound to this road and with me."
"Yeah, I think we are good with all that," Naomi said, standing up quickly. "An eternity of what, monsters and psychonics in exchange for a few decades alive? How much sense does that even make? I would rather die than be here forever." Mara smiled at this, as if to say, "Indeed you will." "Guys, let's get out of here." Mara nodded and continued sitting as the rest of us rose.
"If you leave here, I cannot protect you," Mara said. "The demons have a mind of their own, after all. They use my power and I use theirs. But they will rip you apart even if I say no. And I will not be saying no. You can live full lives. The exit to your world is only a few miles up ahead through the western gate. Or you could die terribly here, like all who had disobeyed me."
As he finished speaking, the feeling of white light overwhelmed me again, and I tried to focus on it. Somehow, deep down, my subconscious knew how to harness it, to use it. I concentrated it and pushed it out through my chest, shoving my hands forward. A ball of blinding lightning soared through the air and hit Mara square in the neck. His impassive, cold smile quickly fled his face and he fell back screaming.
"Run!"
I said, and we all went to the front door. Mara's house was near the end of the town, the penultimate building behind a huge stone castle. The castle dwarfed all the houses and shops of the town, seeming to stand 20 stories tall with turrets and spears rising from all sides of it. The massive oak doors at the front were wide open. As I ran through them, I heard Max screaming. Turning, I saw the marble-white skin of a woman walking on all fours. Her mouth was ripped open from ear to ear, and she crab-walked backwards at an insanely fast pace before leaping and biting deeply into Max's shoulder. With no guns, I couldn't reach in time. I pulled out my pocket knife and I tried stabbing at her, but the three or more abominations ran out from the bushes, one biting at my leg. I screamed and fell. Naomi ran over, kicking her in the face and pulling me up, and we ran out of the castle as fast as we could, slamming the heavy oak doors behind us. From the window in the door, I saw Max writhing on the ground, surrounded on all sides now as dozens of these corpse-like women emerged from the forest. They seemed to only want to watch him and ensure he stayed in place. Then, from down the road, I heard the roar of an engine. A tow truck approaching and the black-haired corpsed woman scattered. A average-looking middle-aged white man got out, a large belly bouncing under his uniform which read, "Death's Cap Towing Service." He pulled out a hook from the back of his truck, whistling to himself as he did so, and walked over to Max. Max's eyes grew wide, and I saw it happen in slow motion. The tow truck driver slammed the hook into his neck, causing a waterfall of blood to feed the thirsty dirt below. Max began choking on his own blood as the tow truck driver, still whistling, got back in his truck. He pulled the winch in, pulling Max off the ground. Max twitched and writhed on the cable, each gasp causing fresh torrents of blood to pour down from his white shirt. And the man started the engine and pulled off.
"Holy shit,"
Naomi said, sounding like she was having a panic attack.
"Holy shit, did that just really happen?"
I nodded, tears streaming down my face.
"We're not getting out of here alive, are we?" I asked. "We must be outnumbered 1,000 to 1, at least."
Naomi shook her head.
"We have to, Jason," she said. "I don't want to die here, choking on my own blood or being eaten by cannibals."
I nodded. We traveled into the castle, finding it laden with tapestries and heavy mahogany tables. Opening up my phone, I found that the signal from the radio tower still reached us here, and that the Wi-Fi still worked, connecting somehow back to our world just as the road did. We found rest in the corner of a large downstairs chamber, folding up tablecloths and rugs for a makeshift bed, and ate what little food we had left as I wrote this all down. Tomorrow, I will either get out of here or die trying. I am not selling my soul for my life, no matter how horrible the death I face in this nightmarish place may be. The feeling of the white light had left me, and instead despair and emptiness had replaced it. But I still remember the voice that told me my entire life has been leading up to this. If that's true, then maybe I was meant to kill Mara somehow. That my life was designed to end this great evil. But in the end, I really just want to go home.